Hi, I'm Brianna Contreras, Associate Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive.
Hello, I'm Peter Werwein. I'm Senior Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive.
Welcome to MHE Talks, Improving Patient Access, a new podcast series part of our Tuning into the C-Suite podcast from Managed Healthcare Executive.
Patient access is a challenge that everyone in healthcare seems to have been talking about for decades. It's one of those big tent problems of American healthcare, a topic that takes in everything from practical problems like transportation to a doctor's appointment, or maybe in today's telehealth era, spotty Wi-Fi. There are also financial barriers to access, such as high out-of-pocket costs, and structural barriers, such as deeply rooted healthcare disparities and racism.
Our new podcast, MHE Talks, Improving Patient Access, will feature healthcare leaders and executives who are working to pull down the barriers to patient access. The goal is to have a lively, informative conversation about a foundational issue in American healthcare.
Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Peter Werwein, and I am Senior Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive. And today I have the great privilege and honor and pleasure of speaking with Stephen Pearson. He is founder and president of ICER, the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review. And for those of us who write and edit and think about drug prices, ICER is an important organization and well known, and maybe just a tiny bit feared. I don't know. But thank you for the time today.
You're welcome, Peter. Nice to be with you.
So, the focus, we could talk about dozens of things, but I wanted to focus today on your recent report that came out in March about the high cholesterol. Medications and glycerin and bempedoic acid. But I think there's a bit of a backstory here that maybe we want to quickly go over because this was an area that where ICER really made its mark. And for those who don't know, there were a pair of drugs that came out, the PCSK9 inhibitors, Repatha and Praluent, that were priced at about $14,500 a year. It was high, and the drugs didn't do very well in the market. People questioned their value. And ICER entered that discussion with an analysis, I think, that came in showing that their value, that according to their value, they were priced quite a bit too high. So, Steve, maybe you can pick it up from there. Do I have the right end of the stick that this is an area where ICER sort of made its bones in terms of ICER setting the standard for what prices should be?
Well, we had been in existence already for almost 7, 8 years at that stage. And so there had already been notice to our work given, especially around the time of the new drugs for hepatitis C. And that's kind of what kind of just turned up the amplitude on people's kind of radars looking for the next big drug that might kind of be a big budget buster, if you will. And issues around pricing and value, which had been percolating in the background, were just ready to surge forward. And then not too long after the hepatitis C drugs came the PCSK9 inhibitors. And what was unique about them was that they were a completely new paradigm of care for patients with high cholesterol. There are obviously a lot of patients in the country who have high cholesterol despite using the available pills. And so the potential for the budget impact was so high that it raised people's attention. So, our approach is not to worry so much about the short-term budget impact, but to really try to capture the long-term value in the way that we look at value. And so even doing that, looking at the PCSK9 data at the time of its launch, we did think that the list price that they came out at was far too high to match up with what was going to be the likely clinical impact. Because remember, at that point, we didn't even have the clinical trials that said that it did prevent heart attacks and strokes. We just had trials that showed that it lowered cholesterol. So taking that on its face, we did a model that said, connecting that to the likely downstream reduction in heart attacks and strokes, how valuable would these be and what would a fair price be? So when we came out with a much lower price, I think it actually just affirmed what many payers and others were feeling, which was that this seemed like an expensive drug for the clinical value that it was going to provide for the average patient, not for every patient, but for the average patient.
And although one can't really make it a cause and effect, your assessment of the value, in fact, has become pretty much the price for these drugs that they started, as I said, I think roughly priced at a list price of $14,500 a year. And they're now priced in the neighborhood of $6,000 a year, which is sort of roughly where you said their price should be based on their value, correct?
Again, there are a few other shoes that dropped in the years that followed. First off, as you mentioned, the drugs they really struggled in terms of their uptake. And part of that was because the pharmacy benefit managers and the health plans, very sensitized again to what had happened with hepatitis C drugs, really put the brakes on in terms of the access criteria for patients to be able to get the drugs prescribed. And so there was a lot of friction around that really, I think, did make it hard for clinicians and patients. And then the companies were waiting, trying to actually kind of, I think, market their drugs through those barriers when their clinical trial data became available a couple years later. And that actually showed that the drugs were not quite as effective at reducing strokes, heart attacks, and at saving lives as we had even imagined several years before. So we did an update to our report, but at that point, I think the companies were ready to basically approach things differently. And it was at that stage that one of the two companies, Regeneron, said, when you have your updated results, we are ready to price officially in that range. And we are going to go to the payer community and say, we are now responsibly pricing. We really want responsible access to be provided so that patients and clinicians can get better access to these drugs. So that happened, and the prices came down. The competitive, given that there were two companies, both drug prices kind of came down in tandem. But you know, the VA system and others have been using our reports to try to negotiate lower prices all along. And as they got down to a lower price, we did start to see market share shifting and some of the uptake improving for these two drugs.
So let's fast forward to the report in March, and let's first talk about inclisiran. I guess, is it in fact a PCSK9 inhibitor? I know it has an RNA mode of action, but I'm just wondering, do you see it in the same class of drugs?
A clinician would tell you that it serves the same purpose, and it actually does work in the same biochemical pathway, that part of the cholesterol story, if you will. It's not a PCSK9 inhibitor, but it kind of works at the back end of the same biochemical pathway. And it has strikingly similar clinical results, about a 50% reduction in the bad form of cholesterol. So that's why a lot of clinicians will just kind of conceptually think of it in that same class, if you will, even though technically it's not.
But how about in terms of formularies and whatnot? How do you see that playing out? And I'm giving it away, but I think you said in the early March report that you came up with a price, you, ICER, not you, Steve Pearson personally, of about $5,600, which would put it right around the two existing PCSK9 inhibitors. So I guess I'm not sure what my question is in that statement. I guess I'm just wondering whether it's, you know, whether we're looking at this drug as another drug in a pre-existing class and that basically should be priced the same.
I think in general, yes. Again, I would probably shy away from calling it in the same class just because that has some technical kind of meaning, but its role in therapy will be very, very similar. Now, A couple of things. Our report is done, but the FDA has not yet formally decided whether to approve this drug or not. They haven't been able to get overseas to check the factories, and so there's some interesting issues there. But it's also a drug that, even though it is also administered similarly, it's administered just twice a year, as opposed to every 2 or 4 weeks. And so there's a feeling that that may have some, for some patients in particular, a clinical benefit, because they can get it in the doctor's office, make sure they get it when they come in for their biannual visit for many of these patients. And so there's a sense that it may provide a nice addition to the armamentarium of doctors who are always looking for new ways to make sure that patients bring their cholesterol down. The other thing about this drug, though, is not only is it not FDA approved, but again, at this stage, we don't have the clinical trial results on strokes, heart attacks, and mortality that will come again in a few years. So we're kind of assuming for the time being that, again, the reduction in cholesterol will kind of translate through into those good outcomes for patients in the same way, but we'll know more in a couple of years, and we may need to revise our report accordingly.
Now, there was a equity analysis as part of your report in March. And forgive me if that is something that you've been doing all the way along, but of course, equity, health access to care, and healthcare disparities are much more part of the everyday conversation of healthcare than they were a couple of years ago, I think. And certainly maybe when you were doing your reports on the PCKS9 inhibitors several years ago. So could you, I guess, a two-part question. Are you doing equity analysis and discussion in sort of a new way at ICER? And could you just discuss how you applied that and how that got framed up in the discussion of inclisiran?
Sure. That's a great question. We actually, I forget how many years back it goes now, but it's been a while. We have recognized, as everybody does, that treatments may or may not have a large effect on reducing health disparities in our country or reducing health inequity, depending on how you want to frame it. And that and that may not kind of come obviously out of the clinical trial results. You just have to think of what the effect is going to be in clinical practice, and which communities will this drug be particularly helpful. And it may be racial disparities, but it could be urban, because some treatments might be really helpful to be able to get out to people in rural communities and therefore kind of reduce disparities of rural versus urban patients. And in this case, we, as always, wanted to highlight whether there might be particular advantages to the new treatments that would have again, the ability to expand treatment into communities that might not have great uptake or serve other purposes in ways that would help us reduce health inequities. So we do talk about it in our reports. We talk about it at our public meetings, and our independent committees that we convene to kind of vote on the evidence. We have them take a specific vote on several different kind of contextual factors, one of which is whether the treatment is likely to have a significant effect on reducing health inequity, because we really want that message to get into the usual discussion around value that payers and others will have when they think about new treatments.
And where did you come down on inclisiran and whether it in fact might, depending on the uptake and the pre-authorization and all that jazz, whether it would in fact has the potential for closing disparities, or maybe in the way that it's put out there in the wild, widen them?
I think we did hear, and we had one clinician expert at the table who specifically has spent his life kind of helping to serve underserved communities, especially in the Black community. And we heard from him that he thought that it would be for many patients that he would care for an advantage to be able to administer the drug there in the doctor's office and not have to rely on them getting new prescriptions and kind of that process, which is hard for all patients to a certain extent. But we spent a fair amount of time just talking about how to launch this kind of new treatment in a way that wouldn't increase disparities. In other words, often we find that when a new treatment's available, it first goes to people who are really plugged in to academic health centers or have other ways of finding out about new treatments. So we talked a lot about how do we get the word out that people should be checking their cholesterol? How do we get the word out that statin drugs are the first line of care and are for most patients incredibly effective and helpful? Because there's already a huge unmet need, if you will, just on that end of the scale, even before you get to the more advanced treatment options for the patients who still need them. So we talked a lot about, again, rollouts through community centers, different ways to make sure that patients are informed and educated and involved in the decision-making around what treatment is best for them. So that's part of our report, and actually part of our mission as well, is not just to think about the fair price, but how do we think about what fair access would be and how do we make sure that that access is fair across all different kinds of communities?
Nonetheless, is kind of, A1 in this discussion. And the press release about this report, you talked about not squandering an opportunity here, that there are been some innovations in treatment of high cholesterol that is either resistant to statins or people who, or in people who can't tolerate statins. And that price can sort of undo the effect of innovation. So I guess I'm curious what you meant by squandering. You used that word squander. We got to be careful here about not squandering an opportunity. What were you thinking about?
Well, this kind of connects back to the very first question when we were talking about around what happened with the PCSK9 inhibitors. So we have innovation leading to a treatment that really does address an important unmet need. And yet we all should just be aware that price and access are just linked at the hip. And we just can't assume that a price that's not viewed as fair, that's not viewed as well aligned with the benefit to patients, isn't going to have an adverse effect on people's ability to get that treatment. And it did feel that the first few years after PCSK9 inhibitors came out, that there was an opportunity squandered then because of all the friction and the difficulty of patients and doctors to prescribe it. And certainly the companies felt like their uptake and their revenue wasn't good. And I'm not even sure that payers really, nobody viewed that as a win. I don't think anybody did. It was almost like a hard lesson that had to be relearned in order to maybe get it right the next time around. So that's what Let's Don't Squander This Next Opportunity was about. We have another new important treatment option, bempedoic acid as well, that can help certain patients. Let's not squander it. Let's try to get the pricing fairly aligned. Let's get the health system to welcome the use of these inappropriate patients. And if we can get the price aligned at the front end, that just gets the ball rolling in the right direction.
Good. Well, I think maybe we should leave it there. So thank you very much. So that's the end of the formal part of the interview. I should know this, but I was confused about something and I just read the summary. I didn't have time to go through the whole 213 pages.
Peter, I'm so distressed. You didn't read the whole thing, really.
So where does the 819 million figure come from, and the fact that we're talking that, I'm confused about that.
It is actually hard. That's hard to understand. I'll try to give you the elevator version of it. So, and actually PCSK9s or hepatitis C drugs are not a bad example. Sometimes we have drugs that are great long-term value at a certain price. But if we have 10 million Americans who need the treatment tomorrow, and we have to spend all that money right now.
Yeah.
It's just going to be a huge budget impact in the short term to get that long-term value. And we at least need to keep our eye on that, because if that could mean that we actually need even a lower price, even a fair price for the long-term might need to be lower if we're going to be able to afford it in the short term. Or maybe we need to stretch out the payments or figure out how to treat some first. That's what that 819 million is an attempt to use the anticipated growth in the overall U.S. economy and say, if we're going to have a fair amount of drug spending as part of that going forward, how much could this new drug gobble up in new spending before we start to push the budget warning signs? It's a rough estimate.
Yeah, it's sort of the cost of the drug by the times the number of people who use
in the short term. And it's a short-term measure as opposed to what we usually focus on, which is a long-term value.
But I was struck that at that price, 5644, that you would hit the 819 figure with just 4.5% of the, I wasn't sure what the eligible patients were. That would suggest that one out of 20 people who might benefit from this right. drug, that if you started to really get over that one out of 20, it would start to have a budget impact that right. you'd have to lower the price.
So the reason we put it out that way is because we're not actually saying that only 4% should be treated and then you should stop, or you should keep the price down so that you can treat everybody necessarily all at once. We're just saying, we got a potential issue here that we still have to talk about. Even if we think that price at $5,600 is fair, do we think in the short term we are going to try to treat more than 5%? If we are, what do we want? And maybe this is the drug in which we say, fine, we're going to blow the budget and spend it all right here, but maybe we need to save it somewhere else. It's just to kind of get people thinking. So what doesn't happen is the other way to squander this opportunity, which is if we have a good drug and it's even reasonably priced for the long term, but payers still think it's too expensive in the short term on the budget impact. And so they still put the difficult kind of
tightening. Yeah, okay. They still make access difficult.
Because we're trying to avoid that too.
Thanks for listening, and keep an eye out for the next episode of the MHE Talks Improving Patient Access podcast series. Episodes to this podcast can be found on our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.